part of you.
Well, we hope life is good for our listeners. That's our theme music from Sarita Murdoch's Many Lines. I'm Sheldon Brown, and this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. We are funded by Framework, and we have a focus of empowering mental health, emphasizing hope, recovery, positivity, and therapies such as mindfulness and meditation. And I think hope and recovery are going to be themes of our talk with our guest today. It's fair to say that our guest is passionate about rebuilding her life. After alcohol got a hold on her and she dabbled in dope, our guest, Leah Dowdle, says adventure was a huge part of her life for her first 35 years. Today she's adopted a more compassionate and caring approach to herself and to others. Leah wants to showcase herself as someone with the courage to make changes. And boy, that really does require courage to make changes and also to help others do the same. So here's Leah to tell her story. Leah, welcome to Take It From Us.
Thanks, Sheldon. It's great to be here. I'm really glad to be a part of Take It From Us today.
Great. Well, you've done a little bit of media and in the States as well. What, you said South Florida, you did a radio show there and a bit of television?
Yep. Did some of that work around humanitarian effort to sell aid to Haiti quite a few years ago, back in 2010, I think it was.
Sorry, what was that? A sail aid to Tahiti?
To Haiti.
Haiti?
Yeah.
After the earthquake?
That's right, yeah. After the earthquake. So that was the humanitarian part of my adventurous lifestyle, if you will.
Well, you were involved in what? Sailing and boating. And so that ties in sail aid. Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so after the earthquake, I was sitting in South Florida with my family and we had a yacht and there was such a backlog of aid getting into Haiti. So we came up with the concept of Sailors Without Borders and decided that between our yacht and yachts around us, since we were sitting there, we would take aid down to the island of La Gonave and deliver it straight there, which then created a relationship with the AAE, which is a children's association, and took them, their needs and water filtration systems, and moved to a place of giving back, if you will.
Wow, well, I had no idea. You never mentioned any of that humanitarian work that you'd done when we had a coffee together earlier this week. Well, that's absolutely wonderful. I mean, it sounds as though it must have been, what, quite adventurous, but also very satisfying work.
Yeah, it was. It was adventurous, satisfying, but it was also stressful. And the stress of giving back to others really showcased to me what I was doing to give out to others and not taking self-care of my own mental health or my own environment, which then led me into this place of what I'm here to talk about with you today.
Well, I mean, that's a critical thing, isn't it? When we step out to support other people and look out for other people, we do sometimes get highly stressed because maybe they don't have the courage to make changes. Maybe they continue with their addictions or with their bad lifestyle, which impacts their mental health, and we as supporters can get frustrated.
Yeah, can get frustrated, definitely. And a lot of that is outward projection onto others, and that way it's actually easier to get frustrated at what they're not doing and take the focus of what you're actually not doing for yourself.
So it's about self-care, isn't it?
Yeah, and it all comes down to self-care. And for me, I'm very driven and passionate, and I can see that I will put myself second. And in doing that, it creates an imbalance in my life. So as a driven, focused woman, I've really had to learn to step back. And I'm continuously doing that every single day because I get wound up on my own hamster wheel, really.
Well, that's a wonderful little image, isn't it? Being wound up in your own hamster wheel. We'll have to talk about that a little bit later. But let's start where we agreed we were going to start, because I think over coffee this week, we've already mentioned having that coffee down the road in Pointe-Chèvre. You said as a kid that you saw the drugs and alcohol with a way to have fun. How and where did you learn such a message?
Well, I grew up here in the beautiful New Zealand, and in the culture that I grew up in, it was very synonymous with my parents growing up at the same time. And so when, as a young child, I learnt that when my parents were happy and everything was running smoothly, there was something associated with that, which was alcohol and drugs. So that pattern was ingrained in me. I also have that gene which runs through my blood and the environment. So it made it a perfect nestling space for me to feel somewhat, to identify, really, to identify with that is my world and that's what works.
I mean, when you say you've got that gene, do you mean that you feel that you inherited an addictive sort of gene?
Yeah, and I don't want to place blame at all on, you know, poor on me. It came from a gene of mine. It just is. It's a gene that's been passed down through my ancestors, knowing that with their history, they've had problems with mainly alcohol. And so it is, that is what it is.
Well, we say in mental health that there's a 20% chance that you're going to inherit any mental health issues from your parents. So I guess there's nothing very unusual about it. And if your parents were using drugs and alcohol a lot, I mean, what was your sort of, I guess, understanding about it? Surely you would just accept that this was a normal thing to do and get stuck in.
Yeah, it was part of my environment. I didn't have any other way of seeing that wasn't the normal, really.
So which of the two, drugs or alcohol, which did you feel were the most scary for you personally?
Personally, after the journey that I've been on, I would say alcohol is definitely my darkest shadow, because alcohol is so socially acceptable that it's on every shelf as you go into the supermarket, and acceptable in the sense of social environment, it's easy to get. Where drugs, say marijuana, it's still illegal, so therefore it's something that is on the other side, and I would have to go looking for it per se.
So when did you start drinking?
Interestingly enough, I had this conversation with a friend the other day. I remember I was 13 years old. But again, growing up in that environment, I would have sips of my dad's beer. So, you know, as a young kid, that was, have a sip of dad's beer. But the first time I ever grabbed a bottle of wine was 13 years old.
Right. Well, we had a mother in the studio here not so long ago talking about addiction and wanting to promote an addiction conference, actually, that was on March the 18th in Albany. And she said that she had a very strong-willed daughter who somehow ended up at a party, tried pee at the age of 11, thought that she could manage it, didn't manage it at all, and became very severely addicted. I mean, it's very young, isn't it, to be experimenting, 11 or 13 in your case.
Yeah.
What was your perception of alcohol then? I mean, did you know that it was a drug?
I don't know that I actually put any perception around it at all, because it was so accepting. It was there. I didn't actually like the taste of alcohol. I never have. And
never have?
No.
Really?
It's really interesting, eh?
How did you get to drink too much?
I know. It was probably trying to fill the void. Or it was escapism. And it was the feel-good that I got, the high that I got from alcohol. Like I said, at 13, when I had that first bottle of wine, it was to fill the void of not feeling enough. not feeling worthy enough. My parents had gone through a divorce. I had just lost two friends to suicide and one to drink driving. So at a very vulnerable age, the alcohol seemed, it seemed like when I picked up that bottle, it was something to, my dad does it, my mum does it, I'm going to try it, I'm going to try this. And it tasted disgusting.
And yet you'd lost a friend to a drink, to somebody who was, had been drinking and driving, killed themselves perhaps?
Yes, a friend of mine, Julia, lost her life in a car accident at 13 years old. And what surrounded that was a very, quite a, if I look back on it, quite a traumatic time for me, with everything else going on in my life. There was no support given, and that's, again, nothing to blame on my parents. It's just, it wasn't acknowledged of what my needs were. And so to go ahead and do something unruly, if you will, or scary with my friend, oh, let's get a bottle of wine, it seemed very natural.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty tough experience that you were going through. You'd lost this girlfriend. She was only 13 when she was killed in a drink driving accident.
Yes,
yes. And you mentioned that two people had committed suicide. Your parents had broken up.
So one person committed suicide, my good friend Mana, and my parents had divorced. So there was a lot of change in my life that was happening.
But at the age of 13, it's, I mean, I think back to 13, life was a bit cruisy. I knew that there was some, you know, there was some internal feelings that I couldn't get a handle on. But generally, I was bike riding around Sumner in Christchurch. I was surfing. I had good mates. Life was pretty sweet, although I did feel quite a sense of loneliness, but nothing like the challenges that you've described. I mean, was there any support at all?
There was support through the school. A couple of support groups were put forth for the other, the girls and myself. Not what I've experienced now. So not what I've seen that's been offered now out there in the awareness that's around suicide prevention and or working with grief.
Did you feel grief as a 13-year-old? Did you know what it was?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think I really acknowledged it. I mean, we went to the funerals and obviously there was grief at the funerals. But apart from that, I think it was a very much a mentality for me being the eldest child was pull your socks up and keep on going, keep moving forward. I was quite a resilient child and so therefore it was... I guess I came to a point of accepting that is what it is and then we just keep on growing and moving up, really.
Sort of sounds like, you know, just harden up and harden up and get on with it. Regarded now as not the most helpful advice to anybody who's in grief or whose mental health might be a little vulnerable, and it would be understandable. Did you feel that your mental health was under threat?
No, Sheldon, I haven't, you know, really identified with this until years and years later. It's not something that, even though my mum has worked in mental health and I hear the language that she uses and the way that she has processed things, I've always really admired that. But I wasn't around my mum enough to actually learn from it because I left New Zealand at such a young age that I basically set off and ran away from any acknowledgements of grief or needing to process anything that had scarred me, really.
So this move overseas, it sounds as though it was a sort of an escape.
Yes, Definitely. Most definitely.
And what was the form of that move overseas? Was that involved with sailing and boating and that sort of thing, was it? Or was it just a take off? And
it was 17 years old. I'm out of this country. I'm either going to end up pregnant, addicted to drugs and alcohol, or stagnant in a place where my sense of self was, I need to succeed. I need to succeed and do something with my life. So it was very much ambitious.
And you've described yourself as adventurous, driven, yeah. Like the mouse on the, remind me
yeah,
again.
Yeah, the hamster on the wheel, for
the
sure.
The hamster on the wheel, yeah. So where did this desire at 17 to take off, leave New Zealand, go overseas, where did that take you?
It took me to Australia first, where I went and worked in the hospitality industry and the adventure industry as well. So I was working in river rafting, and then I went and decided that since I lived on the Great Barrier Reef, I better get on the yachts. So I just took my hospitality knowledge and went and worked on the yachts. And then from there moved and set sail to America.
So that was the start of a big adventure. That how long did that last?
Gosh, so let's think. I came back to New Zealand in 2012.
Right. Well, let's take a music break. We're going to commemorate Chuck Berry, the rock and roll legend who died recently at the age of 90. What a magnificent contribution he's made, and many very famous musos, rock and roll exponents have praised him for his contribution. And we've got a track called Memphis, Tennessee. roll legend Chuck Berry with Memphis, Tennessee. We're talking to Leah Dowdle about her life, with alcohol, but obviously not just with alcohol, with all sorts of other adventures as well. Leah, you've just recounted how you came back to New Zealand some time ago. But while you were... Well, I guess you were involved in the hospitality industry on big boats, big yachts and that sort of thing. Was alcohol a factor during those years?
Oh, of course it was. Yeah, alcohol and the working on the super yachts goes hand in hand pretty much. It's work hard, party hard. You make a heck of a lot of money. Being in beautiful, adventurous, different places at different times. And with that, if you're not smart enough to be putting that money away, it's going right down to the bar and having a good time.
Right, down the drain.
Down the drain, down or up the wall.
So what was your experience with saving money?
Oh, terrible. It was terrible. I mean, I was trying to send money back to New Zealand in drips and drabs, but I was very spontaneous in my lifestyle, and it was pretty much spend the money on looking fine and drinking wine, really.
Well, looking fine and drinking wine and being the hamster on the wheel. It sounds as though it could have a catastrophic ending.
Hence why I'm sitting here talking to you today.
Right. So when did things sort of turn around? Did it take coming back to New Zealand to have a realisation that maybe you might be addicted to alcohol?
Yeah, it did. I've always had an innate sense, because my dad's an alcoholic, so I've had an innate sense of what it looks like and what I didn't want to turn into. So from all of my running away and continuing this movement forward so I didn't have to look at myself, created that environment for doing a move from the States back to New Zealand to pretty much find some balance and get myself together. But it still took a couple of years of being back here. It wasn't until 2015 that I basically found the gift of desperation and couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't live the double life of the selling and showing myself in one sense and then behind closed doors, drinking to escape, really.
You just used the phrase, the gift of desperation. Mm. That seems like a conflict, that desperation is hardly a gift, but in your case, are you saying that you got to a desperate stage and that made you realise that you needed to do something?
Yeah, it really did. It was to that point of live or die, and so the gift was... do I either continue down this path of probably death, or do I have the courage to make a change? And it was really, really hard. It is the hardest thing I've ever had to do, actually.
So what were the first steps in that you recognised that, well, if you carried on the way you were going, you probably were going to end it all? So it was more than just your description to me over coffee that you toppled off your perch. It sounds even more serious than that.
Yeah, if I'm really honest with myself, then I had to acknowledge, it actually came back down to my children. And I had to acknowledge that in the environment that I was creating and the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, was I was actually putting them into the environment that I'd grown up with. And so therefore desensitizing them to what was becoming normal for them. Run from your emotions. Don't acknowledge that you're in pain and use a substance to counter that. And so when I looked into their eyes, I knew that if I didn't change, there wasn't going to be any change. I wasn't going to break the chain that had been handed down through generations to me, really.
I mean, I guess the thing with alcohol is that it does numb us, doesn't it? But I guess if you drink too much of it, it also brings about pain the next day, or even the night you're drinking or the day you're drinking. Is that your experience with it?
Yeah, the pain of realization that I was so incongruent, and that falseness that I felt it actually started to create a hatred within myself. And I could, being a person that comes from promoting health and wellness, which was my industry, I could feel it in my gut. And I knew that that was the symptoms of starting a disease, which was my disease of alcoholism, that allergy that comes with it. But it was also a dis-ease in my soul, in my psyche.
Discomfort.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a real conflict that was developing in you. Is that part of the desperation that you describe?
Yeah, it was. It was a desperation. I mean, you can call out to your higher power, your God of your own understanding, as many times as you can. I used to sit out under the stars with a glass of wine saying, I just pray for health and happiness. And, you know, my higher power was saying, well, girl, you know.
Drop the glass of wine.
Yeah, you've got to make a change. If you're not going to, you know, I'm not going to help you until you make that change, and the courage is stepping forth and stepping into the light, really.
Well, let's have another music break, and then we'll talk about how Leah took that courageous step. We're playing rock and roll legend Chuck Berry, who died very recently at the age of 90, and we're playing rock and roll music.
Just let me hear some of that rock and kick against modern jazz, unless they try to play it New York band and change the beauty of the melody and make it sound like a symphony. That's why I go for this rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it, got a backbeat, you can lose it. Any old time you use it. They gave a jubilee. The country folks, they had a jamboree. Drinking homebrew from a wooden cup. And everybody got all tightened up. Started playing that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. Five feet, you can lose it. Any old time you use it. Wanna hear him play a samba? Way too late for the congo. Not too early for the mambo. Keep a rockin' that organ. So I can hear some other rock and roll music. Chop any old way you choose it. Chop back beat, you can lose it. Chop any old time you use it. Chop gotta be rock.
Well, that's rock and roll music with Chuck Berry, the rock and roll legend who died just recently. We're talking to Leah Dowdle about her journey with the glass of wine, I guess. What step was it? What was the critical step that you took? You were sitting under the stars, you were calling on your higher power, but you still had the glass of wine in your hand, so I guess you wanted the best of both worlds. Surely there was something else that you needed to do, a step that you needed to take.
Yeah, and it was really hard. I had to remove myself from my environment, which meant that I had to leave my husband at the time, and I had to leave my children. I actually had to physically remove myself from the environment to go and seek help.
And did you do that by you shifted towns, maybe you came to Auckland where there is a fair degree of support for alcohol addiction?
Yes, I did. So it still took me a few more months because I was in great denial, and I was still going to go down the avenues of trying all these different alternative therapies because I wasn't ready to accept and label myself. I still have a hard time labelling myself now, only over my own stigmatism. But after a few months of being out of that environment, I came to the realisation that I was going to have to seek help through a rehabilitation centre here in Auckland. And I really owe my life and where I sit now to the services that have been offered here in Auckland. I have such a passion to give back to the services through what I can offer in my field and the tools and skills that I have to those that are suffering from mental health and or addiction.
Do you want to name any of those particular services and credit them with where you've got to today?
Oh, yeah, of course. Higher Ground is an amazing facility. And for a place here in the South Pacific that offers 4.5 months of treatment, that does psychotherapy work within the underlying patterns, because the alcohol and addiction is only the surface of what lays beneath. And what laid beneath for me is the grief and the abandonment of that 13-year-old young girl. And Wings Trust as a pre and post therapeutic community for those going into treatment and then exiting out of treatment. I would have to say my greatest work has actually been bringing myself out of Higher Ground and into Wings and having that support of other people in the therapeutic community.
Did you have to walk into those rehabilitation facilities on your own?
Yeah, that was something that, because I actually came through the Bay of Plenty to start off with, so I actually started my journey through Manning Street, and Steve King of Manning Street said to me, the greatest step that you can take is going to be one of your own fruition, so you need to make that step because nobody can tell you. So you have to have that courage to stand up, put your toe in the ground and take that step forth. So it was scary, but I did it. I had to because maybe that drive inside me, it comes from a place of ego as well and wanting the best out of my life.
Well, it's not a rehearsal, is it?
No, Leah? No, it's
many,
not.
Many people told me that when I was in the depths of my mental health challenges, you know, this is not a rehearsal, Sheldon. I guess their message is, well, you could be wasting your life the way you are at the moment. Mm. It's a subtle way of probably saying, well, make some changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you describe this as your life's rebuilding, don't you? Whereabouts are you with it at the moment?
At the moment, I am at the stage of acknowledging my skills that I've attained over my years, and where I sit today as a woman in recovery, and blending them together. And what is my life purpose that goes from here? How can I be mindful of my health and give back to those so that it helps them rebuild their lives?
So what particular life experiences and skills are you going to bring? I think one of them is yoga.
Yes.
And you've already started with a wonderful gesture because you're involved. You and I met at a hui in Manukau run by Drive Direction, which is a consumer organisation, and they were promoting a weekend away, weren't they, for Tangata Whaiora. How did you get involved in that?
Yeah, I'm really blessed to be able to utilise the services of Drive Connect down South Auckland and also Care NZ. Once in this community, there's so many aspects to it that offer these different workshops or programs that those people can come together at, like, the drive weekend that we were just in. And I came into that through Denise Omar, who I believe you've had on your show as well. And she suggested that I come down and teach a yoga class. Because I'm wanting to blend the yoga with addiction and how to come back into the body, I was able to present that class in a way that takes the stigma of yoga, actually, that it's only for, you know, it's an elitist practice, or it's for people only in spandex, and bring it down to a place of everybody can do yoga. If you're breathing, you can do yoga. And for those of us that have had addiction challenges or mental health challenges, to get out of the mind and get into the body is the greatest benefit.
It's the greatest challenge as well.
Yeah, it is a huge challenge, isn't it?
How do we get out of that mind?
And it's through the breath. It's through the linking of the breath. And that's through linking of the breath, you're finding that mindfulness. And it is really hard to do, but it only has to be in small increments. It can be 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, building up. But it's about not berating yourself or thinking you're not doing it well enough. It's about making it available to everybody.
Well, I had the privilege at a philosophy class. I met a yoga therapist who I believe you've had a connection with, Vandana Stedman, who practices yoga therapy in Oniwa Road. I'm hoping very much to be able to interview Vandana at some stage. But yes, she has reminded me about the importance of breathing, and I think I do a lot of shallow breathing, and when I intensify my breathing, I feel so much stronger and so much better mentally. And it's a simple technique, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about the benefits of that.
Well, from what I, if I can relate it to this weekend, last weekend, working with the people that actually had never done any type of yoga before, and teaching them from an aspect of, a lot of us breathe into our chest, and what that is breathing into a shallow breath. So we are continuously hypervigilant on this fight or flight. And with that, it's increasing the fight or flight nervous system reaction. By deep breathing, by taking a moment, taking a deep breath, it actually helps ground down. It becomes fully aware of moving forth past the diaphragm, or into the diaphragm, beg your pardon, past the chest. And it centers, and it gives the body more oxygen. And it helps the mind become clearer, because we're not only working from a place of hypervigilance in the nervous system. So the breath in itself, there's a great cartoon I came across one day, and it's very apt for people in today's modern society, of two women with yoga mats walking to a yoga class saying, you know, who would have thought that I'd be paying $25 for someone to teach me to breathe? Because we all think, oh, well, I'm breathing. But are you really? If you stop and take a moment, just take a moment, ground down with both your feet, and breathe down into your belly, and you will notice the benefits straight away. It's about acknowledging that.
So is that one of the sources of your courage to rebuild your life?
To take a deep breath?
Yeah.
Yeah, step off the hamster wheel.
Right.
And take a deep breath.
It's about taking a pause,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, pausing.
And in the philosophy class that I am doing, they remind us that taking a pause every so often, we do it in the class. The class is about 2.25 hours. We have a little introductory meditation. But before we go for a cup of tea, we have a pause. Mm. And when we come back, we have another pause. And I'm introducing this into my life. And I consciously say to myself, Sheldon, take a pause. I can feel the exhaustion, you know. I've been racing on that hamster wheel, and it's so beneficial.
It certainly is. Taking a pause, what I really like to bring people's awareness to is unlocking your jaw.
Right.
It's really, you know, because we hold so much in our shoulders and in our jaw. Again, the shallow breathing from the chest. We're only working from the chest up in our embodiment.
And I guess if we're in an office where we're sitting, working in front of a computer 8 hours a day, and we're not feeding our abdomen, we're not really feeding the rest of our body.
Yeah.
Yeah. What other things? You've referred to well-being, and you describe yourself as really the new me. Mm. What other things are you doing as part of this rebuilding?
Oh, what else am I doing? See, I think what I'm doing is continuing on this journey of discovery. So for me, it's becoming a lifestyle of implementing all the tools that I have acknowledged that I feel good about being okay with being enough.
Being okay with being enough.
Yeah, that's huge for me because I drive to succeed and drive to consume, actually. So the other aspects that I'm doing is being able to be enough and being okay with, I'm a teacher, I'm a guide, and I can teach others through different yoga practices or different yoga studios around Auckland, and not comparing. And for that,
when you say, sorry to interrupt, but not comparing, you mean not comparing yourself with the well-being, well, not the well-being, but the consumer image of friends who appear to be doing incredibly well, material possessions, big car, whatever.
Mm.
So that's a trap that we can get into. We can sort of believe that these people are doing much better than we are. Probably all of it is leased.
Yeah, exactly. And that consumerism, that drive, that comes from ego. So again, that comes from working from a place of shallowness, and that can be shallow breath. Mm. When I take a deep breath and I ground down, I can actually walk with more purpose. And that self-discovery allows me to be okay with the challenges that I will face, because just because I'm in a place of recovery doesn't mean I'm not meeting my challenges. But I can meet my challenges with a place of integrity now. And so adapting all of life's challenges to where I sit today allows me to become a lot more balanced.
A lot more calm, I suppose.
And calm, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk some more about those positive benefits of rebuilding one's life. We've got Chuck Berry on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and we are playing Reeling and Rocking.
It was 12:45. I said, come on, baby, let's have a little fun. And we reeled. Looked at my watch and it was 12:45. You know, she said she didn't, but I know she do. And we reeled. watching it, it was quarter to three. She said, wait a minute, Chuck, I gotta go take a, give me a Coca-Cola, somebody. Watching it was quarter to four. You know she turned me around. We had to do it some more. Watching it was quarter to five. You know I didn't know whether I was dead or alive. I was rocking. Watching it was way past five. We was rolling like a stingray on a 4-day drive, man. We were reeling, rocking and rolling, reeling, rocking, rolling, rolling. Looked at my watch and it was quarter to six. You know it took a little time, but I finally got him fixed, and I reached. I was standing there firm like a cement mix. Yeah, I was reeling and rocking and rolling, child. We were reeling, rocking, rolling till the break of dawn. Looked at my watch and it was almost seven. We lit a cigarette and took a trip up to heaven. Now, watching it was quarter to eight. Along about that time, she made me stretch out straight. Yeah. Ah. Oh. E. Ooh. Looked at my watch and it quarter to nine. She said, "Ooh, Chuck, baby, this show feel fine." Watching it was quarter to ten. You know she called me right back, made me do it again. And I looked at my watch and it was 7:30. She turned back, called me something dirty. You know why? It was straight up 12. I bounced back gigging like an old steam shovel out real. A rocket, a rolling till the break of dawn. Rocket, rolling till the break of dawn. Olé! Olé!
Well, that's Reelin' and Rockin' with Chuck Berry, the rock and roll legend. And I must just make the point that I got a double LP, Chuck Berry and Little Richard, some time ago from, they used to be a chain of stores called the Gold Mine. And I walked into one in Ponsonby because Framework had its offices in Ponsonby. And I picked up that double LP of Chuck Berry and Little Richard for $2. That's my best music bargain ever. Anyway, I digress. We're talking today to Leah Dowdle about the rebuilding of her life. And it's been a fascinating story and is a fascinating story. But how much better is life now than when you were drinking, Leah?
Oh, well, it's not as insane, that's for sure. I definitely have found that balance and balance quality of life. My quality of life is not as insidious with chasing what I think is referred to sometimes as the demons on my shoulders, really. It's about the clarity of what's my life purpose, what is the ripple effect that this change in my life has created to my loved ones, or what can they benefit from it as well. So there's a lot more integrity in my relationships. There's a lot more love for myself and a lot more awareness that my humility is therefore increased in compassion for myself and therefore others. So a lot more real.
So really, as a role model, you've changed dramatically. You've done a complete 360, I suppose, have you?
Well, I've always had these aspects to myself. I was brought up with really good morals, and even though in this environment that that I was brought up with, I don't want it to come across that it was bad or negative. It was, and so therefore, my love for others and for my humanitarian aspects was installed in me at a very young age. So I've already had those aspects. I feel as though I've really just been able to embody them with a greater sense of integrity, really.
I guess the alcohol, though, sort of masked all that. It, I don't know whether you had characteristics when you drank too much. I mean, some people get a little bit angry or obnoxious or difficult, yeah, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm probably not a great role model. It masks the love and the humanity that clearly is very clear in the way that you project yourself today.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I was very aware that the aspects of me, the shadow side, if you will, that would come out when I would drink, were something that I would feel terrible about the next morning. And so there's that self-hatred that would come about. Now I can realize that, okay, I have these character defects in me, which is called by actually Carl Jung, which is the shadow. So for me to embody my shadow, to actually be okay with that being part of me, gives me a sense of balance. And that's something that I can hold and be okay with.
I just want to clarify there, is there still a shadow?
Yeah, well, from my understanding and learning, is that the shadow work is something that all human beings have. And so those are the defects of the characteristics that we hold, whether or not it be through fear and loathing, through jealousy, through, you know,
comparison.
Comparison, exactly. All of that sort of stuff. And it's about becoming into that state of mindfulness, being mindful that I have that feeling of getting angry maybe at the gentleman who's cut me off in traffic. I don't get angry. I just I just go, okay, well, you know, it is what it is today.
Do you practice mindfulness?
Yes, most definitely.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely practice mindfulness, which is interesting because it's actually quite a cliche word these days, isn't it, to be mindful. And another meditation teacher said to me the other day, really, do we really want to be mindful? Aren't our minds full enough? And it made me reflect, okay, you know, do I need to become mindless?
Well, there's a bit of a debate around that. I know some of the critics of mindfulness are saying exactly that. Do you want to have a fuller mind? But I think mindfulness is about living in the now. It's being present, you know. And so often when we're conversing with people, we can see they're not exactly present. They're probably thinking about what they've got to buy in the supermarket or what they're going to do tonight, which bar they're going to go to and which friend they're going to ring. And I mean, it's so obvious. But it is so respectful of the other person to be present with them.
And I find that in myself, if I'm talking to you and I feel my mind is drifting, I will actually stop and take a deep breath and then readjust my gaze so that I'm looking you in the eye. And today I find that so many of us, and I'll say my children included, will talk to me through their phones. And there's that disconnection, and the disconnection is what I actually became disconnected with my life, with my family, and I was seeking that connection through alcohol or drugs. Now I have that connection through relationships, through being mindful, being present. And the connection is a human need. And it's
being,
so much more beautiful.
I would suggest being sober as well, which is a huge respect to others, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. And it's a respect to yourself. To living on this earth.
Well, I think there's so many more things we could talk about. I'd like to have you back to talk about connectedness and community, if you like, relationship as well. And maybe we could do that in another couple of months.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leah.